Where do I put this fire? This bright red feeling. This tiger lily down my mouth. He wants to grow to 20 feet tall. I've left Bethlehem and I feel free. I've left the girl I was supposed to be. Someday I'll be born. I'm so tired of being shy. I'm not that girl anymore. I'm not that straight A anymore. Now I wanna sit my legs wide open and laugh so loud that the whole damn restaurant will turn and look at me. Look at the tiger jumping out of her.
Spring, it's officially here. Now the days are longer than the nights. The sun will warm the earth and warm us. Green shoots sprout up and blossoms prepare to burst their color and their fragrance. Animals get active, too. In humans, it's called spring fever. Spring is a time of renewal and rebirth. Our stories related to this time of the year are about fertility and rebirth, rising again from the depths of earth, following the lead of the seeds that lay dormant in the dirt until the sun and the snow melt coax them to rise up and live. Just as Jesus rose from the dead. Just as Persephone, stolen to the underworld by Hades, returned from that dark realm at springtime. Now the Greek myth of Persephone and Demeter provides some wonderful analogies of the world and its workings. I'm going to tell you a little bit about that. The goddess Demeter. She with a golden, grain-colored hair. She controls the seasons and brings forth the fruits. But when her beautiful daughter, the deep-bosomed Persephone, was abducted with Zeus's approval, Mother Dio raged across the earth, looking for news, looking for Persephone. No one would tell her what happened. And she raged. In her rage, the great goddess caused a great famine. She exiled herself from Olympus, first hiding among humans as one of them and letting herself go, so to speak. Her gloriousness was hidden. And what an apt analogy for the earth. Demeter stopped caring for herself, not eating or drinking or bathing, and likewise, the earth stopped taking care of itself and producing. All of this because her child, her seed, was deep underground where the sun couldn't touch. Now, eventually, Zeus called Persephone back up from the underworld because he was anxious to get his tribute of ambrosia and other fruits of the earth that were offered by the starving humans. And they, of course, couldn't offer it as Demeter let the earth become unproductive. And Hades let Persephone go from the underworld, but begged her to return, saying he would be a good husband. In her joy and her relief at seeing her daughter, Demeter did let the fruits and the corn spring up again. Eventually, she returned to Mount Olympus, too. But there was one change that couldn't be undone. Because Hades had tricked Persephone into eating the seed of a pomegranate while she was underground with him. And that trapped her into returning to the dark realm for part of the year. Every year. And when Persephone is underground, Mother Demeter lets the earth go dormant and brown and unproductive. But when the great goddess's daughter emerges like a seed from Mother Earth every year, in the spring, the earth, too, is reborn to much rejoicing. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio, and I'm Sandy Billings. For spring, we're talking about birth, and rebirth. Starting today's show is a rebirth story. My sister Sherry and some other close friends did our first sweat lodge ceremony at a retreat center in the Oregon mountains. The only man in the midst of this women's retreat was our shaman. Perhaps a dozen white women, some of whom knew what to expect and some who didn't, like us. The sweat lodge is a rounded belly of a tent covered in skins with a small flap opening. We crouched down and entered the hot, damp, and totally dark interior of the lodge and sat down on Mother Earth. Blessings had already taken place, and the ceremony began.
There is total darkness. Immediately, a woman begins to sob. The sound is guttural, filled with the pain of every woman's sorrows. The rocks glow. It is the only thing visible in this confining place. Water splashed onto the rocks. They hiss in protest and the steam rises. The air is suffocating. The pebbles and sand dig into every inch of exposed flesh. My eyes are burning from the medicine applied to the glowing rocks. From every pore, sweat cascading like small rivers, merging with the tears and the snot soaking the ground beneath me. Still the woman wails, her cries now taken up by many of the other women in this heated circle. God, it is dark, confining, heat and steam unlike anything ever experienced. Jesus, I can't breathe. I'm scared, I exclaim to the darkness. A gentle word is spoken, the flaps open. The temperature outside is over 100, but when it touches our skin, we smile and feel temporarily refreshed. Tentatively, we women look around, making eye contact and smiling that half smile, then quickly looking away. We study the ground, thankful for the light and the comparatively cooler air. Our shaman speaks words of comfort and wisdom. It is okay, he assures us, to be afraid. The magic here is strong today. We women creating the need for comfort and for healing. Just remember your prayer. The ancestors will see you through the rest. The flaps begin to close one by one. I look around until the last one closes, one last eye contact made before the darkness descends. Immediately the heat once again overtakes the cramped space. Our shaman ladles out more water onto the glowing rocks. As the rocks hiss and release their steam, we women groan, both rocks and women protesting the application of water. We twitter with uneasy laughter, sisters now, knowing we've all felt the same things. No longer quite as afraid of the unknown, we have an idea now of what to expect in this ancient sweat lodge ceremony. Our shaman begins to beat his drum. He sings in Sioux. There is something familiar about his foreign words. I hear it in my heart, and it pulses with the comfort, much like returning to church after a long absence. The sobs of us all mix with a song, all of woman's sorrows, regrets, hurts, perceived wrongs, suffering, disappointments, flowing from every pore in a cascade of sweat. The steam, the heat, the sweat, and the sobs joining up in the darkness and swirling around and through each of us. Too powerful to name, but nearly an entity in and of itself.
Should we
darkness, I reach for the hand of the woman beside me. The touch, the comfort. We're okay. This is good. We release and go back to oneness. Rocking, I concentrate on finding my breath. I can do this. I want to do this. The heat is overpowering. 1,000 hells have nothing on this. My mouth moves in a way unfamiliar, and I keep touching it, amazed at the words I do not understand, but keep singing. Our shaman calls upon our grandmothers to protect us and guide us through this journey. They envelope us in their arms, and they kiss us. I see her crinkled face, and I hear her, "Granny loves you, baby." I pray for her forgiveness. "I'm sorry, I'm so sorry." And I ask her to help me make it through this. I find a small stone on the ground, and I pick it up, concentrating hard on the feel of it. I can't think of much more than the heat, the stifling heat. "Find your breath," the shaman says softly. Somehow, even in the darkness, he knows. He knows this is getting hard. We are now straining from the sorrow, the sickness, the heat, the steam, and the magic. Restlessness and sobs that become wails. The breaking point is near. A cold splash of water hits me. I swear I can hear it sizzle. From the darkness, he expertly relieves all of us, one ladleful of water casts expertly to each. A gentle word is spoken. The flaps open. Light intrudes. Cooler air comes in. Bolder now, we look at each other, redness from the heat and the tears marking our faces. Around the circle, a smile, a dazed look, relief. I made it through. Good sweat, our shaman says. We groan and laugh and try to relieve aching backs, bent legs, broken hearts. I notice other women with their own worry stones and I smile to myself. The respite is brief. The fire tender is asked to bring in 7 more stones from within the intense fire outside of our lodge. As each one is brought in, as before, I acknowledge them with our pipe. The shaman tells us what each represents, words meaningful then, but now forgotten. One is dropped and it splits. A good sign, says our leader. The flaps close. Darkness ensues. We groan when we hear the sizzle of the steam. The shaman then calls upon men to protect us. They hold us from harm, cloak us in safety, making up for all the wrongs other men have done. He calls them in and they rise up from the steam, seated on horseback. They come in and sit silently in front, behind, and between us. Sings and beats his drum. I concentrate but cannot internalize his words like before. My stone, my prayer, nothing works. The heat and the steam overwhelming, taking my breath, my concentration. The walls are closing in now. I can't breathe. My heart is beating hard. I want so badly to finish, but my journey is now ended. I need to go, I say. Water splashes me. A soft word is spoken, and the flap opening is lifted again. I crawl out of mother's womb, out of the wet heat, covered in muck, out of the tiny opening, into the light, so blinding I cannot see.
Sherry Billings wrote her Sweat Lodge story as an assignment for a creative writing class from her home in Florida. She works as a project manager for the consulting company Fox Systems. The next piece on our Yin Radio show about birth and rebirth is about birth. Nothing symbolic or psychological, just the straightforward story of the birth of babies. Alice Swan has 2 children, Rex and Enzo. She shares these stories of their birth with us in the next installment.
When I got pregnant with Rex, I wasn't planning to get pregnant right at that time, and it was right. I mean, I found out I was pregnant a week after I moved to Moscow from Minneapolis, and I was pretty freaked out by it. And I think that it took me a while to come to terms with, you know, being in Moscow and being pregnant, and so I didn't expend a lot of energy on sort of educating myself about birth because I just sort of assumed that everything would be fine. You know, I called my health insurance company and said, I'm pregnant and I don't know where to go. And they said, oh, go to this doctor. And so that's what I did. You know, I didn't, I didn't know anybody to ask, you know, and I didn't ask any questions. I just went. And then I took the short childbirth class that was offered at the hospital that didn't really teach me very much, and just kind of assumed, like, you know, the doctor would say, oh, the baby's head down, and I'd say, great, that's the position he's supposed to be in. Well, I didn't know it was a he, but as it turned out, Rex was posterior, and the first time I ever heard anything about a baby being posterior potentially being a problem was after he was born.
But Alice learned a lot about having babies and what could go wrong, at least, if not wrong, what could deviate from the simple story of contractions, dilation, push, 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 and out comes baby.
So I have very long labors. I was in labor for 44 hours with Rex before I had a C-section.
Needless to say, Alice was pretty tired as that labor went on, but she had been hoping to have a natural birth, so she had held off any interventions for a very long time, for 44 hours to be specific, and a lot happened in those 44 hours.
I was 2 weeks overdue. I started labor on my own the night before I was scheduled to be induced. My contractions were 30 minutes apart when they started, which I subsequently have learned is generally a bad sign that you're going to be in for a long, a long labor. But all night, things were progressing. They were getting stronger, closer together. We called the hospital, and we were almost to the point of, you know, lasting 5 minutes apart, lasting 1 minute for an hour or something like that. We were almost to that point, and then it stopped. So we had called our families, said we're going to the hospital, and then it just kind of stopped. So I had a doctor's appointment that morning, and I went in, and the doctor stripped my membranes and then said, go to the hospital at 5 today, because if things are progressing, you will need to go in, and if they aren't, we're going to induce. And I just didn't question it, and I went in, and things had, I mean, the contractions had started up again. So we went in, and the first thing that they wanted to do when I got there was break my water. And I just sort of said, okay, I guess that's what we do. But my son was posterior, and he got stuck that way because once you break the water, there's not much room for the baby to be able to turn. And so I never dilated past 5 centimeters. And I had Pitocin after, you know, after I don't know how many hours, but, you know, I have been at 5 centimeters for... Pitocin is the synthetic, it's like the drug that causes contractions that they give you to induce labor or to augment labor. And it's really awful because it causes really strong contractions that are really close together. And especially if you've been, you know, up for 2 nights, as I had been when I got it already, it's just, it's really hard. The Pitocin then caused Rex to go into fetal distress. And so they stopped, and then they started it up again at a lower dose, and he still wasn't responding well to it, and I still wasn't dilating anymore. And so then I had surgery, and, you know, 10 minutes later, he was born.
So it hadn't gone as simply and smoothly or naturally as Alice had expected. Having the C-section had not been her plan.
It was really disappointing. It was emotionally difficult to sort of, you know, to see. There's some, like, in some way that I felt like I wasn't a real mother because I didn't actually, you know, give birth. And I know rationally that that's not at all true, that that's not what makes you a mother, but it was something that I really wanted to do. And I didn't. And I just felt like somehow, like my body had failed my baby.
A big part of Alice's birth story is support during the birth. Alice and her husband Nick did have support through this long birth. Their friend's mom was a labor and delivery nurse in the hospital, experienced with many births. She wasn't on duty when they went in, but she did come to the hospital to be with them.
Having this older woman with us who's been through birth so many times and knows how everything is supposed to go was just so comforting.
Alice's first birth story, along with the support of the experienced woman and the long labor and the complications, led her to a different approach when she became pregnant again. She hired a doula early in that process. A doula is a birth assistant, not a midwife, but an experienced woman with birth experience and education. She knows what to expect, what the options are, and how to provide physical relief to the mom. And to the dad, too, sometimes, especially if he needs reminding of what his job is, or chilling out. The partner can get pretty busy and pretty lost, especially when mom is in pain. When Alice got pregnant the next time, she started reading. She wanted a VBAC, a vaginal birth after C-section, so she started planning.
So I spent all this time reading about birth. And one of the things that I learned was that if you have this, early labor that starts out very slowly and stalls out, like, often that can mean that your baby is in a bad position. And that if you give it time, that things can, and it can, you know, it could be that it would have taken 5 days, you know, from when I first started. But if you give it time, things will work out. And the baby, he very well could have turned if I hadn't just gone to the hospital and had my water broken. So I also, like, given that my labor had been so long, and I just felt like I needed, and that we had had this friend of ours there with us who was very helpful, but I sort of felt like I wanted to hire a doula who I was paying to be there for me, to be my advocate. And because it's a little bit different when we had this woman there who was our friend, who was a labor and delivery nurse, because I didn't feel like I could say to her, you know, this is the way that I want you to do it, which, and a big part of that was, I don't want you to offer me pain medication, you know, whereas if you're hiring a doula, you can say, I don't want you to offer me pain medication. If I decide that I want it, I will ask for it. And you can, I just feel like you can be a little bit more sort of assertive about the way that you want things to be. And that's their job, is to do what you want them to do.
Alice hired a doula, Stacy Pettit. She took a Bradley childbirth class. She saw a chiropractor and an acupuncturist to help the baby position himself well. She was even careful to sit right. She became admittedly a bit obsessed with baby positioning.
I was having acupuncture to help position the baby in a good way. And he was not, He was head down, but he was kind of sideways when I started labor, so he wasn't anterior, but he also wasn't posterior. I woke up on a Friday morning in labor. It was actually my due date, which was really incredible since my first son was 2 weeks late. And my contractions were 2 to 5 minutes apart. And I thought, this is great. You know, and I was kind of aiming for like 18 hours, which is, you know, not short, but, you know.
Short compared to.
Right. And so I labored at home, and we called Stacy, I think, in the afternoon, and she came over, and we did a lot of walking around, and, the contractions were pretty intense. They were not ever regular, but still 2 to 5 minutes apart. And I should have realized, and Stacy was, you know, never sort of said anything about going to the hospital, because my contractions weren't regular, but I was just so stuck on, like, this one's going to be easier that at a certain, well, and then I started throwing up, which is, can be an indication that you're approaching, that you're in transition, you know, that baby's going to come pretty soon. So anyway, at a certain point, late Friday night, I really wanted to go to the hospital because I was thinking that I was probably farther along than I was. And we went, and I was 3 centimeters dilated. So one of the rules at the hospital was that the doctor for VBAC is that the doctor has to be on site the entire time that you're there in labor. And so they called my doctor and he said, she's not in active labor yet, I'm not coming in. So the early labor is like up to 4 centimeters. 4 to 7 is active labor, and then transition is 7 to 10. And then so he said, she's not in active labor yet, I'm not coming in. So as often happens, once I got to the hospital, things kind of, the contractions slowed down, spaced out. And Stacy suggested that I might want to have something to eat because I hadn't really eaten all day. And the nurse told us that I couldn't have anything but ice chips. So the thinking on that is, if you, and this is a VBAC rule, not a general rule for everybody, but if you have to have a repeat cesarean, if you end up having to have an emergency cesarean and have a general anesthesia, then you're not supposed to have anything in your stomach, right? And I knew that that wasn't quite right, but I just, you know, when you're in labor, you're just not in a position to argue with people because you're concentrating so hard on what your body is doing, and it's not fun. And so, you know, after the nurse left the room, Stacy sort of said, well, do you want me to go get you something to eat now? Because that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. And then she also said, you know, if you weren't a VBAC, they would send you home right now. And she said, I think we should leave. And we did. And I'm not sure, I think that the idea would have crossed my mind if she hadn't been there, but I'm not sure that I would have actually done it.
But Alice did do it. They left the hospital. But of course, it wasn't over.
So we left, and I was in labor for 2 more days. And we had, Stacy spent that first night with us at home, although we were all sort of trying to sleep. And then in the morning, it sort of became apparent that this was going to drag on for a while. And I had come to terms with the fact that the contractions were going to need to be regular before, even though they were painful and hard, they weren't regular yet. So it was Friday night when we had gone to the hospital the first time. And then on Sunday morning, things were still kind of, this whole time also, I had never gone more than 15 minutes without having a contraction.
Even when things had slowed down, it was still 15 minutes.
Yes.
Ooh, you're tired, mama.
Yeah. And I was able to sleep some on Friday night, but Saturday night was really hard. I didn't sleep. And so Sunday morning, I decided that I wanted to get checked again, partly because Saturday night had been much harder. The contractions were, like, I'd say probably 7 to 10 minutes apart, but they were really strong. I mean, I was trying to sleep in my rocking chair in between contractions, but I had to stand up during the contractions. Oh. It was the only way that I could get through them. Sunday morning, I decided I wanted to get checked again, so we called the doctor, and then we called Stacy to ask her to come and go to the doctor's office with us. And so he met us at the office and checked me, and I was still 3 centimeters dilated. At that point, I sort of felt like we might as well just go into surgery now because this is never going to happen. I was so frustrated and demoralized that things weren't progressing, especially because it was so hard. And Stacy just sort of said very calmly to the doctor, well, what do you think our best option is right now? And he said, you know, I think your best option is just to wait and do nothing. And so with the two of them sort of convincing me that that was the best thing to do, I went home again, and we sent Stacy home again because he still was not, you know, it didn't seem like anything was really going on. And I got sort of mad about all this and that, you know, like, because I wanted to do something, and so I was trying to do, well, and the other thing is the doctor said, I don't think that the baby is quite in the right position yet. I don't feel the head pressing down really well against your cervix. So he's probably just a little sideways and needs to turn a little more, and then once that happens, you know, things will happen. So I went home and I started walking sideways up and down the stairs, which is a good thing to do to kind of jiggle things around that can help the baby turn around. Lunges are another good thing to do for that. Anyways, so this whole time also our older son had been with a babysitter. And so we also had called her and had her bring him home. So I was walking sideways up and down the stairs, and then suddenly something changed. And I was like, I knew then that the baby had turned a little bit, that I was now in active labor, because the contractions, they did get regular and they got so much stronger. And this was not very long after we had come home from the doctor's office, and I didn't want to, like, because this had dragged out so long, I didn't want to, like, call Stacy back right away. I didn't want to, you know, I didn't say anything to my husband either. He was outside playing with our son. But after a while, I just couldn't do it myself anymore. And so I went out to tell him that things seemed to be moving along, and I was really, you know, I was in need of support. And he sort of said he didn't believe me. He said, well, let's just give it another hour. And I was like, oh, okay. But then really, when he came inside and found me in the shower, like, swearing at everything, then he called Stacy back and the babysitter. But also, I mean, at this time, I was just exhausted. And so not that long after, I mean, it was sometime Sunday evening that I said, I want to go to the hospital and get an epidural because I'm just done. Well, and I mean, the other thing is that we had gone through this whole thing with Stacy where we had been walking all over. I had been in, you know, 18,000 different positions. She had suggested that I get my breast pump out and pump because nipple stimulation is one of the only things that's, you know, only sort of natural ways of inducing labor that's actually scientifically proven to work. and it didn't help me at all. But so, I mean, we had tried everything. And Stacy was, you know, she said, you have given it your best shot. You don't need to feel bad at, I mean, you've been through so much. You've tried everything. You deserve to go get an epidural now if that's what you want. We called the doctor and said, we're going to the hospital. Alice wants an epidural. We went in and they checked me, and I was 4 centimeters dilated now, but I also was, I had been not fully effaced before, and I was. Then?
And that means position?
No, it's the thickness of your cervix. And the other thing is that the baby was farther down in my pelvis. So things had progressed. And then Stacy said, once we got there and they checked me and things had progressed, she said, do you want to try just laboring a little more without the epidural since, you know, things have progressed? That's a good sign. And I was feeling so much better then because I had been at 3 centimeters for 2 days. And so I did labor a little longer without the epidural. And then the doctor was at the hospital because I was in active labor. And a couple hours later, he checked me again and I was still 4 centimeters. And so at that point, I was like, he said, I think that we should now try augmenting with Pitocin. And I said, I am totally willing to do that. I am thrilled that we're going to do something to speed things along here, but I don't want to do that without getting an epidural first. So I did. And very, I think it was about 5 hours later that my son was born. So the whole beginning part of it took a very long time, but it was the... And then in the end, so I had an epidural, I had Pitocin, I had the vacuum extractor also. So it wasn't exactly the natural childbirth that I had envisioned.
For Alice, education and advocacy made the difference in her birth experiences. It didn't go as she had hoped either time, but it went as it did. And she was prepared as she could be anyway, for the unknown. And she had Stacy to be her voice when she got tired, frustrated, or if she just plain passed out.
So even then, after I had the epidural and the Pitocin, I was kind of lying on the bed dozing off. But, you know, Stacy was there for my husband because I wasn't in any condition to be talking to anybody. And I'm sure that Nick was nervous, you know. So it was nice to have somebody there for him. And she took pictures. You know, we have pictures of, you know, Enzo being born and of... right after he was born. And one of the things that was worst about the most unpleasant things about the C-section was that the baby is born, and from the moment that they take you into the operating room until the baby is born is a very short time. And then Nick left with Rex, and I was just there in the operating room for, I mean, it takes like 45 minutes or an hour to stitch you up after a C-section, and there I was by myself, having just had a baby, and he was gone. And so one of the things that I felt very strongly with about having a doula the second time around was, even if I had a repeat cesarean, I really wanted somebody to be there with me in the operating room after the baby was born, just to hold my hand.
Among other things, Stacy was there to hold Alice's hand. Stacy Pettit is a doula and a Bradley instructor who has 2 children and has attended some 20 births. She and her fellow doula, Vivianne Fisher, spoke with me last week, and I look forward to bringing you that interview here on Yin Radio in the coming weeks. You can learn more about doulas on the web, including at palousedoulas.org. And doula, by the way, is spelled D-O-U-L-A. Labor Pains and Birth Stories. It's a collection of essays on pregnancy, childbirth, and becoming a parent. Jamaica Richter contributed a short essay to the book, Her Birth Story. Now, in this next piece, Jamaica Richter talks about and reads from her story in the book, and I get a sense of Jamaica's rebirth as she becomes a mom at the same moment of her child's birth.
Thank you.
tried many times to write a birth story, but it took a long time to get beyond a story that was mostly a sense of relief about the wonder at successful mechanics, basically. I loved being pregnant. My labors were short and they were uncomplicated. And then considering women who I felt were far tougher and more resilient than I, who had endured hours and days of painful labor that often, more often than not, ended in C-sections that they'd hoped to avoid, or you know, perhaps they'd been on bed rest, I did not imagine that my story, as such as it was at that time, would go over particularly well. So a few years went by before I wrote anything. And then in a writing class, I was given the assignment of writing a short essay in the spirit of elegy. And I don't know what this says about me, that when prompted to write a lament of something or someone who died, I was finally inspired to write about birth and newfound motherhood. But that was, in fact, the case. So I suppose in this piece, I'm saying goodbye to myself as a person of one, and to the notion of my husband and I as a tidy family of two. But I was also working up to a fleeting and irretrievable moment where I first meet my child. The two of us are absolutely new together. Our relationship at that moment, like a still, calm pond. At the threshold. There was before. The chicken curry that your papa made because I had a cold. And the movie that we watched about the 20-somethings and their night on the town. Beautifully self-centered, they did everything and nothing at all. As the credits rolled, there was his casual remark marking the reality that our remaining nights like this were few. And my tears with the admission that, no, the nights like this were gone. There was the bursting balloon inside me and astonished nurses. Did you get a load of her? Smiling and cracking jokes. As I waddled round the corner, excited to have a baby, not knowing what it meant for the coming hours. The stick and flow of the IV drip, squeeze of the monitor belt, a red line keeping time with my pain. There was the searing and the wrenching, white knuckles and timid attempts to push, an obstetrician off to the side absently cracking her knuckles during the pause between contractions, and my psychedelic hospital gown that the next morning was only polka dots. There was the frustration of you squeezing up and sliding back again until I began to doubt nature and what I was meant to do. Then there is you, finally slipping out into a pair of hands that hand you up, placing you upon me, still connected by a cord, belly to belly, now on the other side, and the sound of my breath, stunned inhalations and tears. And this is the moment I die, my life melting away like the ice chips on my tongue, dissolving into purpose larger than myself. Into you and we and the weight of mutual need. This is the moment of fumbling introduction, of love untainted by misspoken words and intentions. An instant, and I am your mother.
Jamaica Richter, from her essay that appears in Labor Pains and Birth Stories. Also from that book, Georgia Tiffany contributed this essay called First Memory.
First Memory. I do not remember being born. I cannot remember being anything before the herb garden, the one my father planted just below my bedroom window. Stone by stone, a deliberate piece by piece of a puzzle so carefully positioned in shape and fit, he almost did not need the mud to hold the stones in place or the purple thyme to seam the stones. Perched on the back stoop, watching him, I stroked the fur of my black and white dog. I remember the organza summer dress tucked between my legs, the dress with tiny navy polka dots, and the mini pleated skirt that flared when I twirled my arms out, head thrown back, eyes focused on the huge spinning bough of the pine. I remember the dizzy fall, the sharp pricks of needles on my legs, my dog barking. I remember the grass stain on my dress that my mother would never be able to wash out, and how my father condemned her for spending over $2 on that dress, and then for permitting me to wear it outside to play with a dog, for God's sake. I was 4. I had words for all of that, but I do not remember being born. Every year, as a creative writing exercise, I ask my students, what's the first thing in your life you remember? I thought I believed, exceptions such as Helen Keller to the contrary, that we cannot remember what we have no language for. I'd wait for their eventual conclusion that language had to come before awareness could evolve into memory. I wasn't talking about photographs or stories relatives told that recreate a memory, and someplace down the line we might assume we actually remember it ourselves. I was talking about real memory. And yet, when anyone has asked me about my first memory, I've recalled that back porch, my dog, the herb garden, the permanently stained dress, my father, and I've always thought I was 4 years old. But recently, when an ex-student asked me the same question, what's your first memory, Georgia? I saw myself sitting on the lap of Santa Claus, watching in horror as he removed his white beard, his pooched out belly still shaking as jolly as the real Santa Claus, and he wasn't Santa Claus at all, but the man I called Uncle Max. Although I've had this memory before, the chronology hit me for the first time. I was 4 that Christmas of disillusionment. The incident on the back porch happened after Uncle Max moved to Utah. That summer couldn't have been my 4th summer. It had to have been when I was 5 or thereabouts. Suddenly, all the memories and their chronologies become or thereabouts. And my dissolving ability to pinpoint time prompts another question. Can we remember nothing but what we're capable of confronting or willing to reveal, if only to ourselves? I saw the headline in a local paper dated December 1st, 2004. Netherlands hospital carrying out euthanasia for a few terminally ill babies. The reporter documented several such mercy killings in 2003, Vatican outrage, and a list of the hospital's qualifying examples, such as extremely premature births, epidermolysis bullosa, which is a rare blistering disease, and severe cases of spina bifida, cleft spine, incomplete closure in the spinal column resulting in neural tube defect. And then I remembered March 17th, 4 days after my 3rd birthday. The peach chenille bedspread, fragrant as newly laundered sheets dried in the winter sun. My mother lying on her side, me curled up close with my head next to her bent arm that rests on the pillow. The whole bedroom smells like my mother, a warm, soapy smell, and the sheets full of cold and light. And she's going away soon. When she comes back, she tells me she'll bring me a new doll. Or at least, that's what I remember her saying. I remember the smells, the dim light under the ivory shade of a small crystal lamp beside the bed, my mother's face, my one hand reaching up to touch her cheek when she says she will go away, my other hand exploring the texture of that chenille bedspread, stroking and fisting the raised, furry part with my fingers. were words like crystal, ivory, chenille already accumulating in my head that enabled me to recall this? No photographs record that moment. I'm convinced no one told me this memory. But the sensory images must have been stored just waiting for language, and the article summoned those images. My first memory. Not when I was 4, but when I was barely 3. The smell of my mother, the touch of chenille, my breath accumulating on a window of waiting. How much farther back might the memory go? The night my mother left, it snowed. I did not know she had gone until morning when I sleepily pushed open the door of my parents' bedroom. Snow-dusted branches of the maples curtained my view through the living room window where I stood to watch all day for my mother to return. And the next, and the next. How many days, I don't know. And when I ask her, she says she does not remember. The questions are old ones. Does it take language to remember? Are there other processes inside us that both store and access what we call memory? How much farther back might the memory go? My mother came back without the new doll, but I'd missed her so much I didn't care. Do I remember seeing the old white Ford turn into the driveway, my father taking out her suitcase from the back seat on his side of the car, then walking around to open her door? Did I have words for my mother then? The way she slowly negotiated one leg, then the other, from the car to the ground, and stood tentatively, pale, fragile, sad. Did she see me so happy and wavy? The doctor assured my mother that it would be best not to name him, not to see him, that he could never survive in the world. My father concurred, insisted. The doctor, I'm told, had projected my mother's baby to have an expected lifespan of 5 days. Without a name, my brother stayed alive 45 days in the hospital. How did my mother go to sleep each of those 45 nights knowing that? Sacred Heart Hospital, less than a mile from our house. My mother has saved the hospital receipt in her dark oak memory box. The total bill, $91. Baby boy Tiffany, born March 18, 1945, my brother. I want to believe he remembered for his short life the sound of night snow sifting off the pines that shadowed the dimly lit parking lot of the hospital, dots of ice gently ticking, some adhering to the window pane. I want to believe he could see from his miniature bed the heavy frost on the glass that morning of the 24th, just before the weather cleared. I want to believe there is some beauty stored in his memory of being alive on this earth. But then, must he also remember hosting the deformed spine, carrying it into the world? And must my mother always remember the distorted body that grew inside her? Spina bifida, I ask her. I don't know, she says. It sounds familiar.
Georgia Tiffany read her essay, First Memory, which appears in Labor Pains and Birth Stories. Labor Pains and Birth Stories was edited by Jessica Powers, and it's published by Catalyst Book Press. Jamaica Richter and Georgia Tiffany read their essays at Book People in Moscow, Idaho, a couple of weeks ago, and graciously re-recorded that reading for Yin Radio a few days later. Birth and rebirth has been the theme today, and we'll end our show with music by Carrie Noble. Her song is called Born Again.
Time. Well, I was told I didn't get it just right. I needed to be born twice. Then I know where I'd go when I die. So I got down on my knees with my whole heart.
You can listen to past shows of Yin Radio, or you can podcast this show, or you can sign up for our electronic newsletter at yinradio.org. You can also find Yin Radio on MySpace and on Facebook. Please drop us a line anytime you'd like at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's yinradio, V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, and it's heard on KSOW 106.7 FM in Cottage Grove, Oregon, and on other stations around the country. Yin Radio is produced by Anna Maria Roque and Sandy Billings. Music is by Paula Cole on today's show, Allison Crow, Asani Longhouse, Maya Filipic, and Carrie Noble. Yin Radio is a production of VP Foundation, and I'm your executive producer and host, Sandy Billings. This show is dedicated to my grandmother, Sue Griggs. Much love and peace, Gigi. And wishing you all a happy spring.